Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Daughters and Sons Hour. I'm your host, Joe Donovan, and we are a weekly podcast where we address issues of concern to daughters and sons of parents with mental illness. Tonight, our guest is Susan Smiley, the director of the acclaimed documentary Out of the Shadow. And we are also joined by Maggie Jerry as our co-host. Are you both on with me right now?
Yes.
Yes,
hi,
I
Joe.
Am.
All right. So we're starting
hi,
off.
Hi, Joe
off.
And Maggie.
I guess we should just start off. Susan, start off, I guess, with a discussion of the movie, which came out 10 years ago, and I just wanted to find out kind of the why you made it and kind of the how it impacted your life and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
And Susan, well, maybe just to start, also you could do kind of an overview of the content of the movie. That would be helpful.
Yes, I'll start with that. I made this film called Out of the Shadow, which was, it's about essentially my mother who suffered from severe and debilitating schizophrenia. And my sister and my years of growing up with her. So the film is essentially about the illness, but it's also very much about relationships and our family members' relationships to my mom, as well as her relationship to the public mental health system, which is a huge subject that I tackle in the film, just from her personal experience of it, which is unfortunately the experience of so many people who suffer from serious mental illnesses. So that's what it's about. It took me 5 years to make, so I think I shot the first footage in 2000. and it took place in the Chicago area where my mom lived at the time. And so I live in Los Angeles, so I took many, many trips back there over a period of years to film my mom, some in a really hard crisis situations and other times in lovely, easygoing situations. But you get a sense over the course of time how what the illness is like from a really intimate point of view and sort of how she changes and evolves and how probably how I do as well.
Susan, I met you in 2003 when the movie wasn't at its final stage yet, but it was being screened at the NAMI convention in Minneapolis.
No, that
and,
was 2004. Yeah.
Was it 2004? Okay. Yeah. And, well, then later we had a chance to sit on a couple panels together when it came to its final form and so on. And so one of the things that comes to mind for me and remembering from conversations that we had at that time that you had to stare at the footage a lot. You had the editing process of creating a documentary is pretty arduous. So it would be interesting to hear a little bit about how you decided to do a documentary about your family, because I think that must have been a difficult decision. And then how did the process of making the documentary give you insight? And then after, for, gosh, I'd say at least 7 years, I think we had pretty regular contact and you were promoting the film in various ways. So however you'd like to share about that, because I think it's a huge process.
Right, yes. Well, I'll start with the making of the film. You know, what I started out, my main motivation for making the film in the first place was to expose the travesties of the public health system and sort of all the misdoings that had happened to my mom. I felt so sorry for her in so many ways because she was essentially a ward of the state for many years. My sister and I hadn't had guardianship. We were off living our lives, and it was just one mishap after another, which only exacerbated her illness. And she had gone through just cycle after cycle of housing and losing her housing and new medication, which offered some hope, and then she went off the medication. And there was just, it was so stressful for so many years. So I wanted to talk about, I wanted the film to be about that. And my mother and actually other people's similar journeys through the mental health system. And I had initially sort of pre-interviewed a number of other, you might say, characters that I was thinking of having in the film, including my mom. So, but over the course of the years of making the film, it became more personal to me, or you might say more personal about me, but it's not what I wanted in the first place. I actually fought it, kicking and screaming, having a voice in the movie. I just wanted to be the person behind the camera and make a really good story. And I also questioned my ability to make a really good personal documentary because they're very hard to make. There's not many great personal documentaries, and because when a person inserts themselves in a film, oftentimes there's a tendency to be sort of a bit indulgent or have it be about them. But I so did not want it to be about me. I hated the idea of it being about me. So, but we were editing for well over a year and tried iteration after iteration after iteration, and nothing was working sort of as a whole. Sure, we had scenes that worked. We had, you know, aspects of it that worked, but I was doing test screenings in my house or, you know, a friend's living room. But my producer, who is one of my best friends for over 30 years, and my editor, who is also a very, very close friend, and my assistant editor, very close friend, they were, you know, I really relied on them for great insight and objectivity that I didn't have. And they must have told me in numerous ways over the course of at least 6, 7, 8 months that I had to have a voice in the film, that's what was missing. And I was like, no, it's not. And finally, they just convinced me to give it a try in a scene or two, and I showed a few people, and they were united front. They're like, Susan, this film is as much about you as it is your mom. So I believed them because it was four people against one, but it wasn't what I wanted it to be. But I also believe in, as an experienced filmmaker, I believe in the collaborative process, and I certainly had great trust in all these people, and I knew they weren't misguiding me. So I just kind of had the faith and went with it, even though I was terrified, frankly, utterly terrified to share myself in this movie. Mm. I mean, beyond terrified. And also it was so painful. And I didn't want to go down that path of my own pain, because that would detract from the story of my mom, her illness, and her journey through the public health system. So, in fact, I really didn't deal with my pain in the movie, which is good. you know, I touched upon it in a couple of places, but that's not what it was about. So the film worked because I still was sort of a narrator, but also a compassionate daughter, yet also objective enough that I could sort of speak from a matter-of-fact place, but also a heartfelt place. So that's how the film evolved. Maggie, I don't know if you were the big premiere screening in New York City.
Well,
it was the new School of Social Research.
I should have been there. Yeah. I was at Columbia up at the psychiatric. I did my master's at the New School. I'm like, oh, I think I should have been. No, I was there. Yeah, we all went out to dinner after. Yes, I remember that. And yes, I was at the New School.
Oh, yeah.
But we also did a premiere at the psychiatric studies program up at Columbia, up at like 160th
right.
Street. And that was right. a NAMI, local NAMI, Metro New York sponsored that. And then we used that to launch the Daughters and Sons Support Group.
Right. And that Dr. Lieberman spoke at that one, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
And then we also did one in Maryland.
right,
Looking
yeah.
back,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were so many. There were so many. But anyway, remember when the film premiered, I was, oh my gosh, I was sick to my stomach. I mean, I was completely nauseous and broke out in hives, and I was just beside myself. And all my New York based friends were there, and many NAMI people I knew, and just and it was terrifying, because A, I didn't know how it was going to be received, and B, I was just so utterly just completely terrified about exposing myself as much as my family members. So anyway, that passed. Well, that was the beginning of a 10-year journey so far. Maggie, I need to be reminded of the next part of your question.
Well, let me just take a moment, because this is an interesting thing to reflect on. At that time, when you and I had just started to get to know each other, and I was trying to bring this idea of the Daughters and Sons movement to various environments,
right.
your film seemed like a great synergy. Like it was fortunate, actually, that you were creating this film, because that's part of why Rick Bickel from NAMI had invited me to help with organizing.
Right.
I think the
that's
synergy
right.
of him,
yeah.
he wanted to promote the film, and I had called NAMI National saying, I want to work on this topic, and I really want to help, you know, build a network across the country for children who have a parent with mental illness. But when we initially started talking and I talked about it in that framework, I always sensed a kind of hesitancy in you about that, because you wanted it to be about the systems and not about the Daughters and Sons stuff only, or, you know, you didn't want
right.
to be focused
yeah.
too much in that area. So, but clearly your film was an opportunity that allowed us to bring this topic to various environments. And so then you went around promoting it for a very long time, and I was only involved in a few of those promotions. You created a learning manual, I think, that people could bring to, like, they could host a party at their home and watch the movie. So I'm curious, how did you learn along the way? Because let me just take a moment to say that I learned so much in organizing that I didn't know just out of my own story.
Right.
So I'm wondering how your process of being out in the public and having that long journey of promoting in so many environments, how do you think about that in terms of your understanding of yourself and how your mom's mental illness may have influenced you, or ways that you learned about yourself in that journey?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, it's very true. And I do remember us talking about the Daughters and Sons group and that coming to fruition. And you're right, I was resistant. And that's very in keeping with how I was feeling for a number of years while making the movie and after it came out. I just did not want to go there with myself and the effect my mother had and frankly continues to have on me. I think it must have been just too uncomfortable, too vulnerable at the time. So I shied away from that. But I was very comfortable talking about my mom and mental health issues, and certainly from a political advocacy standpoint and the public health system, and spewing facts about and talking about community mental health. You know, there was a myriad of other topics that I was really comfortable talking about around the film, so I could actually pretty easily avoid talking about me and my feelings and the impact on me.
mm-hmm.
Now, granted, in many screenings, after screenings, I would always get asked these personal questions like, wow, how did you and your sister make it through that life? You know, how did you, you know, how did you turn out so well? That was a really common one. And, you know, I have to laugh because I'm not sure what so well is, but you know what I mean. And so obviously people got that from the film. And so I do think that as I got more and more comfortable talking about it in public, and then frankly, there was a turning point when I actually just really started totally enjoying talking about the film and the personal aspects that came up through mostly in the Q&As. And then I just became much more open, much more willing, much more comfortable in my own skin about it, much more inquiring myself about sort of the impact that my mom had on my sister and on me. It was very clear to me the impact she had on my father and cousins and her mom, and that was all much more easy to figure out. But my sister and me, frankly, we were damaged. You know, we were seriously wounded. And that's been a lot harder to tease out, I think, for both of us. And obviously a lot more vulnerable to talk about. But anyway, so that's been, you know, anyways, and now I'm quite comfortable talking about it, what I know. And even in some of my graduate studies, I learned a lot about neurobiology and the effect of early trauma, and it's a topic that really interests me. So there you have it. Strange how things evolve.
Are you able or willing? And let me just take a moment to say, as much as you were, you know, hesitant, your film was enormously helpful to the Daughters and Sons movement, and you've never been reluctant to be supportive. So I just want to say that openly, because obviously it was used on a number of events that helped to spark discussions. Then you were always collaborative, and we contributed to a table that we had in a NAMI conference in 2009, and you've always been involved on some level. So
well,
I just want to make sure I say that, because, yeah.
I mean, I've always supported it, definitely. You know, heck, I am one. I feel the pain that we all feel. I have compassion for the positions we were all sort of born into. I guess for the longest time, I didn't feel like I was able to be a good voice for the movement, or just wasn't ready, maybe. But no, it's a really important movement that I hope continues to gain steam, and I'm convinced it's going to help, you know, millions of people, because we really are the, you know, the hidden, the children of people with serious mental illnesses are often hidden from, you know, the crises at hand and the more overt illnesses at hand.
So would you like to share more about this, the neurobiology and some of the things that you were just mentioning that you think you've gained some insights in that area? Or your education background? Yeah.
Well, I'll go into it a little bit because I still don't consider myself at all an expert in this area. But I look back on my own sort of schooling as a kid when I lived with Nellie, and you know, thankfully I was really studious. I loved school. I did pretty well. Despite the trauma that was happening at home. But then I realized later on in high school and college, I started having a lot of difficulties, and it was due to massive anxiety, stress, and depression on my part. And when you're still a kid, you're really, you're not really thinking about why you feel the way you feel. You're just kind of in it, and you go from day to day. But there's been so much research, as you guys know, and brain research in the last 10, 20 years, and it's just, you know, the field has exploded. for which is great. And we just know so much now. And so in learning that, you know, early childhood trauma causes, you know, a chronic stress reaction in your brain and your body, which, you know, essentially causes neuronal connections to be wired in that way, and for you to be, for that person to be on a, in sort of a fight or flight mode way more than a human being should be. I mean, obviously we have these instincts for a reason, for survival. But when a child or any person is threatened, you know, the cortisol just goes gushing out of our lower brainstem and takes over. And as a result, you feel, you know, sweat, you're stressed, you're in your hyperactive mode, your heart rate goes up, and you become very, very reactive because you have to. Oh, I'm going to avoid this screaming battle, or I'm going to avoid this crazy behavior, or I've got to get out of the way, you know, for this or that. But what happens when that happens in a child's brain, a child has such a vulnerable brain. It's growing, you know, by leaps and bounds, and it's essentially acting as every environmental experience that's going on and coming through all of your senses. And so through the age of, you know, the most vulnerable time for a growing brain is up till age 7, and then it kind of slows down a little bit, and then through the age of approximately 12, and then again through the adolescent years, your brain is growing by leaps and bounds from about 12 to 25. So if a child of someone with serious mental illness is getting, you know, mixed messages because they have, you know, their parent who has schizophrenia or alcoholism or bipolar, what have you, you know, it's hot and cold, is really loving one moment but awful the next, is, you know, a child can't really trust and always has to be on alert, even though they don't want to be, because they love and honor and revere their parent. But so their systems are at odds with each other, and it creates a lot of confusion, not only biochemically in the body, but certainly has for me as well in in my processing of my relationships as an adult. And, you know, there's been so many studies that have shown that as adults, children who experienced early childhood trauma have a much harder time dealing with stresses of any kind. That they just can't, they're not as resilient to stresses, I should say. Mm-hmm. And I thought I was, you know, kind of superwoman, you might say, you know, just really together, I could accomplish so much, I could achieve so much, and yeah, I could, but I was so completely, what I didn't see was that vulnerable side of myself and that wounded Susan side of myself at the same time, because I was suffering from chronic depression, and I didn't give myself credit for what I had gone through and really how my biochemistry had changed due to my early childhood experiences. Mm. When you realize it's biochemical, you know, that every experience we have is really imprinted in our neurobiology, that it's not just genetic, that it's, you know, I don't know if you've heard of epigenetics, but epigenetics is really taken over the field of genetics, where we realize now that genes present themselves or not based on environmental factors. So if you grow up in sort of an idyllic home as a kid and you feel safe and soothed and honored and seen and acknowledged and encouraged, and then you have, the people tend to have way more resilient to cope with certain things in life, and they seem to be much more emotionally regulated, and that's not so much the case with children of trauma.
Mm-hmm. As you've grappled with this as an adult, how do you find wholeness and understanding and patience, even perhaps with yourself in understanding that? And then also, are there possibilities? I've heard about things where people can do I heard something at some conference about exercises people can do to rewire their brains. I've never tried to do anything like that, but I've always been kind of curious about that.
Yeah.
So how do you grapple with that now?
Yeah, well, you know, for me, I started with, I went into therapy in my 20s and did therapy for many, many years, and that's very helpful. But also, I've had these feedback loops that just, and I tend to ruminate, and I can't seem to get rid of those, which just continue. They're not helpful. I had a big, long period where I meditated and did yoga, and I still do yoga, and it's great. But I also find that just exercising, like getting my heart rate up and getting the blood moving a lot faster, is in some ways better for me, for my mental health, and for staving off falling into a funk. Mindfulness is such a huge movement now, and it's great that it is. It's great for students, for kids, for everybody. just those are just great, really effective tools for sort of retraining your thought processes, and that's what gradually rewires people's neuronal connections. I think, much more than, I think these companies like Luminosity, who talk about brain games, those are way more, they're not legitimate, I have to say on the record, they're not legitimate. And there's been a lot of research about that, that how they don't have long-term effects. Yeah, it's having this deep awareness of what you're thinking and your own feedback loops and your own tendencies to go to certain places, and taking a step back and saying, okay, that's not working for me, and I see how that is self-sabotaging, and I have to kind of have a greater awareness about that and realign. Every time I think this thought or go to this place and it's a process just like anything, but that seems to be, it's helpful for me certainly. And
I'm also thoughtful of another topic we discussed in preparation, which is that you became a mother. And that has influenced some of your understanding as well. So I'm not a mother. I'm curious about what changed for you in having a daughter.
Well, I knew that, I think like anybody who becomes a parent, it's just this classic, oh, I'm going to raise my child better than my parents raised me. I don't want to make the same mistakes. I want them to have things I didn't have. That's all sort of the classic stuff, right? But
yeah.
But once you dig into the day to day, and you see your kid go through these developmental stages, but also it's just a little moment. For me, it still is raising a little girl, bringing up so many things, and that how I was treated by my mother and father, And frankly, it's devastating, you know, but it's devastating in my own heart and mind. And then I say, oh my gosh, I have this incredible little girl who I, you know, I'm going to do this the right way, you know, or what I think is the right way anyway. And I'll tell you, it does continuously bring up my own past. And too often it brings up really sad things in my own past. So, but that's my cross to bear. Maybe also in becoming a mom and really wanting to deal with my stuff, like in head on, so that I can be the best person I can be and the best parent I can be and not put that on my child. I bet that's also been a huge factor in me being more comfortable about talking about it openly and talking about my my history. Mm-hmm. You know, my child is 10 years old now, and she talks to her grandma Millie on the phone often, and her grandpa Alan. But what things will come up, and I haven't told her much, about my past or grandma Millie's state, but I've told her enough that's developmentally appropriate, and she's asked some pointed questions. So that'll be a process too. I said, you know, my mom wasn't she never helped me with homework, and you know, she wasn't present. Oftentimes we didn't know where she was at night when we were at home, and there was no dinner. And you have this wonderful dinner. Will you please eat it? You know, I don't do that all the time. You know, because a little bit of guilt could be helpful at times, right? So, but you know, when I, and that, believe me, that's not often. It's rare. I break that out, but that's when I'm like, please eat your dinner. I need to pull out another tool. So, and then she'll say, okay, oh, why was Grandma Millie, you know, why did it happen? And I said, well, your grandma was sick. You know, she was very, very sick. She wasn't able to be a good mom to us. She wanted to be. She tried, but she just wasn't able, you know. And her experience of Grandma Millie is a wonderful one. So limited, but wonderful. And so anyway, you know, it's little by little.
That often happens in generations too, right? I think my experience of my grandparents was, it, as difficult as it was generally better than my mom or my aunt or uncle seemed to have indicated.
Right.
That their process, because grandma and grandpa had quote unquote mellowed quite a bit as
right,
I was growing
right.
up.
Right, exactly.
And did your, in all of, having been a part of screenings and having been present when your film was shown and you weren't present, I know people have asked at different times about the level to which your mom has been engaged in the process of telling her story, you know, because you've shared her story through the film, and she did, obviously, she's very clear in the film that she's, you know, she's happy that you're doing that, or maybe she's not at moments, but she's given consent, you know, this kind of goes back and forth, but she's, and now, of course, there's just life and however things are going for her today. Did this allow you to have more conversations with her about your experiences and have those, has that continued to be an opportunity? Like the film, I assume, opened up the ability to talk to your dad a little bit more directly or your mom about how you grew up?
Right. Well, in terms of Millie, and yes, it did allow for that. However, with Millie, I didn't really see much point in getting down and dirty with her, to be honest. Her heart has always been in the right place, and it's very clear that she was too young to have kids. Her biochemistry was thrown completely out of whack, and she was already predisposed to having schizophrenia. So, you know, she has one kid, another kid, and my, you know, and she's, in this marriage that neither of them want to be in, and, you know, she's divorced before and with no support by the time she's 25. I mean, I know it was the 1960s, but if it happens to someone today, that's a hell of a situation to be in, even if you aren't mentally ill. So she just was in way over her head. And she has, on some level, I get and have forgiven where, you know, the wrongdoings, you might say, but it doesn't change my own cellular memory of them and my own lack of self-esteem and all kinds of things that have come out, you know, that I fight with, that I will probably fight with till the day I die, because of her. However, there's an understanding. So it just didn't, and she said many times, and she still says, and I think she said maybe one or 2 months ago we were on the phone, and she said, yeah, I was just a terrible mom, but at least I have a chance now to be a good grandma. So she knows it, and what can you say? You know, I'm at peace with just leaving well enough alone with her, and I always have been. However, you know, I really can't be too close to her physically. She lives up in Minnesota near my sister Tina and her husband Jeffrey, and I applaud them for that. I would not be able to have Millie live near me. I just I know I'm not emotionally strong enough or capable enough. But my experience of my mother was different than Tina's. Now, in terms of my father, yeah, he and I really had it out. For those of you who've seen the film or even just read about it, he's clearly a guilty party in terms of, you know, abandoning these two little girls in a very dangerous situation. And I find him and what he did, frankly, unforgivable. And I've told him so. He was very selfish, and he was very scared, but he let that get in the way of helping his two little babies. And, you know, for an adult to do that when these vulnerable children are around, I'm sorry, you know, not okay. So that, frankly, my relationship with him and is just a lot more complicated and a lot more, you might say, hard feelings. But you know, when as an adult, I've had to just accept him at face value and for who he is. And he himself was very proud of the film and all that the impact it had. And he did give of himself by being interviewed, and that means he opened himself up for criticism as well. And so that I respected. So, yeah.
I'm going to break in here a little bit.
All right, Joe, please do.
You know, we've been moving along pretty well. We've got about 20 minutes left in our hour. So, and I want to throw out and see if anyone is interested in calling in with a question. And if so, the phone number here is 646-564-9557. That's 646-564-9557. Okay, we can go on.
And Joe, do you have a question you'd like to throw into the mix?
I think the other piece, getting back to the movie, I think there's kind of like three kind of aspects of the movie which seem to me like the most relevant. The first one, I think we pretty much did, is how it affected Susan and her growth and maturity and that kind of stuff. The other is, again, the fact that it's influence on other daughters and sons around the country and even the world where it's been play because so many of us can identify with either Susan and or Tina. And then I think the other piece is that it's still very much relevant with in education. And I'd like to ask a little bit about, it is a teaching tool that's out there, and I'd like to get a little bit more information about, you know, who's watching it still and what they're getting from the movie.
Sure, sure. Now, this is so hugely gratifying for me that the film remains this, and still there's new colleges and universities that, new to me, I should say, that order the film to use in their classrooms with mostly graduate students. There must be just sort of this very strong word of mouth with it, but it's used, you know, and when professors watch onto it, they show it in semester after semester after semester. I did a presentation at Boston University School of Public Health last year. There's a professor there that shows it a lot. I went to Creighton University in Nebraska, and that was for nurses and mental health professionals that needed some continuing ed credits. And so it's shown a lot in schools of social work, schools of nursing, and the psychiatric nursing classes. Those are the main ones, public health, social work, and nursing, that I know of. But it's also been showed in ethics classes, which I it's just so great because the film brings up so many ethical issues around someone who suffers from mental illness and the people involved with them and how to handle it. I did that on purpose because it's, you know, this is a massive gray area. There really is very little black and white in life, period, I think, other than birth and death. That's my feeling. But so much of life really is about finding your place in that gray area of choices, decisions, routes to take. So much of things, of decisions we make is contextual as well. And so much of these illnesses, these mental illnesses, are deeply affected by contextual situations and environmental situations. So it's just, there's no easy answers. And so, last year, there was a division of ethics at Creighton University. And I thought that was really, really great that they wanted to show the film around ethical issues. So that makes me really happy. You know, it's really lovely. It's a great feeling.
What are some of the ethical issues that were coming up in that discussion?
There's the main one that always seems to come up in screenings is when my sister and I are trying to get guardianship of my mother, and this is all in the film, and we've got a court date coming up, and wrong scene. When my mother was in the hospital and on a psych ward for weeks, and she refused all medication, and my sister and I were trying to figure out how to get her medicated because they couldn't keep her anymore, but they weren't going to put her in a transitional housing situation unless she was medicated, so they were caught between a rock and a hard place. And my sister coerced my mom into signing a consent for medication by telling her, because we kind of had an idea my mom probably would not read the fine print, and so my sister told her some story about her being able to join her in Minnesota and go
canoeing with her grandson, go do fun things, and my mom signed it, and then she was medicated the next day, and she left that psych ward, and now happily it launched us on a path where we were able to really start some continuity of care, but it for years to come. But it could have backfired. And this is how I generally felt when that in the film. I disagreed with my sister for doing that. But anyway,
it's an emotional scene, and it's a really important scene in your film that touches on a key, what I would say, lightning rod issue in mental health movements in general, an area of strong opinions, disagreements, passions for people who care deeply about people who have mental health, mental illnesses or mental health experiences. And I think the fact that you don't try to resolve it completely, you know, you do allow for the confrontation, and it's it makes sense to me that that would be a very important scene for the ethics discussion.
And other scenes that come up with other issues around ethics are medication and the, you know, psychopharmacology and, you know, the role of psychiatrists and, you know, family involvement, what's too much, what's too little, you know, what's appropriate. So.
Do people ever bring up that they any concerns about the experience of children who are growing up with a parent with mental illness?
Good question, especially with this audience, I think. That's not much. You know, no, not much. And I think it's because I don't dwell on my sisters and my experience in the movie. That I really focus on my mom. That's why I think it doesn't come up. And I have to say, I've been told many times that, you know, there's, and I actually was told last week, that there's another, you know, well, Susan, the next part of your story is now talking about you and sort of the, you know, traumatic childhood and that. But that's not a film I'm going to make. at all, but it is something. But it is something I now talk a lot more about publicly, and you know, in groups of people. And I actually made a couple presentations about it because there's so many children of trauma in this country and in the world. No matter how the trauma was caused, effects are very similar. So, you know, a child of war or a child of alcoholic parent or a mentally ill parent or a child seeing their brother get shot in South Central or, you know, sure, there's different variables and outcomes, but there are some findings that can confidently be said across the board about what happens to children of trauma and how to best not only treat them, but give them a good education, how they can best learn, how to best manage cognitive deficits or cognitive abilities, and how to help them become well-adjusted, reasonably happy adults who can fulfill their life dreams. And that's become a massive interest of mine. So, and that came from my childhood experience, definitely, and my need to kind of, like, without a shadow, this has come out of my need to, okay, what good can I do from all this trauma I had, you know, how can I help other kids, other students, other people?
I have a final question, but I'm wondering about Joe, and I know we have about 10 minutes left. And so,
Go for it.
Okay. So because we have about 10 minutes, I'm wondering if you would be willing to share your thoughts about the Daughters and Sons movement to the extent that you've watched it over these years. And as you've changed in your understanding, and you reflect upon the different efforts that we've had, I'm wondering what you think are the most important aspects of the movement from your perspective and what your hopes are for it as we think about the future.
Well, what the most important aspects? Well, first of all, just starting this, you guys, just really getting it off the ground and going public is huge. And as now, you know, I've been seeing you make efforts over the years. Well, first I think it was quite small and sort of intimate for a while, just a number of people. And I don't know for sure, but you've been sort of brainstorming and doing a lot of, you know, meetings and how you wanted to shape the movement and what form it should take and sort of a public face of it. I think, you know, that's all necessary and brilliant. And because we all need healing, and healing comes from relationship with people who've had similar experiences, with people who really don't just have sympathy, but have empathy. Empathy being they feel what you feel. They know what you know. They get it. And that's what we need, much more than sympathy. We just need, I think, for our healing, we need to share our experiences as adults and the challenges we have because of the early environment we came from. And I know that's only one. I know that's only one aspect of the Daughters and Sons movement, because many of us have our mentally ill parents still alive, and many are dealing with day to day stuff that's just rough to deal with and hard. And but no matter where your parents are, whether they've passed or they're still around, and you're the primary caregiver, or whether they live across country, or you're say a young child, you know, say a teenager. I would, you know, love that young people could find the Daughters and Sons movement, like, you know, teenagers, 15, 18-year-olds that are getting some perspective outside of their families and seeing how unhealthy the environment is, but maybe not quite able to verbalize so much and afraid to talk about it with other people. Maybe they could find solace in this movement. So my hope would be that this movement could speak to many different groups, or you might say age levels and developmental levels of daughters and sons.
I agree. Thank you for articulating
that. Okay, well, I'm going to have one last question, real simple one. Is there something that we didn't ask you that you want to share with us? Something that we've overlooked that that you feel that our audience might like to know?
I honestly can't think of anything that's been overlooked.
Okay.
So maybe, yeah.
Okay, well, then I guess it's time for me to say thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks so
for your
for
continued support.
Yeah, and thank you to Maggie for kind of leading the discussion here. Next week we have another guest. We have Linda Grace Sexton, who is an author of a number of books. The relevant ones that we'll be discussing are her trilogy of memoirs. The first is Searching for Mercy Street, addressing her relationship with her mother, Anne Sexton, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, who took her life back when Linda was, I think, 21. Linda's second book came out a couple years ago, and it's Half in Love, where she addresses her own suicidal attempts and the fact that she's, you know, now as the mother, and addresses some of the issues with her legacy of suicide. And then her recent one, which has only been out for about 3 months, where she actually talks about her dog, who've been with her throughout all her ups and downs. And the title of that book is Be Spotted, because all of her dogs throughout her life have been Dalmatian, and kind of the support that you find through pets and all that kind of stuff. So that's our show for next week. I thank everyone for listening, and we'll say goodbye now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.